Hey, I'm Jason, and welcome to Season 3 of the Tales from the Pit podcast. From the Pit, the behind the lens access for the entertainment world and the creative people involved. Today, we have a very special guest, Siobhan Cronin of Starset. Siobhan, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I got to say, I love the name because when I think of the Pit, I think of all of my background playing in Pit Orchestra throughout high school and college and all that stuff. It's got very Broadway vibe. So I'm totally relating to that right now.
Awesome. Yeah. And I definitely want to talk about that stuff. So yeah, we kind of started this show during 2020, like your podcast as well. And we were all Pit photographers for Live Nation specific venues. Yeah. And we'll kind of talk more about that, but let's talk about you and your upbringing. Where did you grow up? What was music a part of your childhood? What was your original sort of, childhood like?
Yeah. So I grew up in Metro Detroit area, about 30 minutes outside of Detroit. And yeah, music was always a part of my life. I mean, I grew up and we had a piano in the house. And I guess some of my earliest memories were getting up as a toddler and like banging on the piano. And as my mom says, she was just sick of hearing the noise and was like, we got to get her a teacher. And, you know, of course, in the meantime, my parents were not musicians, but they had musical backgrounds. Both had psychology backgrounds. My mom worked in marketing, ran a bunch of agencies. Both entrepreneurs, but very artsy. We were kind of, you know, I grew up in your sort of typical Michigan suburban neighborhood, but we were kind of like the eccentric weirdos on the block, right? You know, we had the accountant next door and the guy across the street. And meanwhile, you know, I'm living in a house where we've got classical music and opera and, you know, a wild European mother and this sort of like kind of funny culture within that house on this sort of standard, you know, suburban neighborhood block. But yeah, music was just all around. And I was lucky growing up in a place where there was just a lot of great high level music happening. You know, there's the Detroit Symphony, a lot of great art, a lot of revival, especially in the last like, you know, 15, 20 years, a lot of people have kind of come back and sort of revived the city in a lot of ways with that. But yeah, I mean, I grew up just being exposed to classical recordings. Going to concerts, going to see ballet, going to see orchestra. And, you know, like I said, I grew up banging on the piano and my mom was like, okay, we got to get lessons. And, you know, as far as I'm told, she had to basically convince a teacher to accept a student at the age of 4 because, you know, at the time it was like, well, no one starts a 4-year-old on piano, but right. I did well enough that she was willing to put up with me. And, that's kind of how it started. And I went to it was sort of like a boarding school style arts focused school where when we got there, I joined in second grade and I was exposed to a lot of kids taking string instruments. And compared to a lot of the other schools in the area that don't have string programs or orchestra, I was pretty lucky because, you know, at age 6, 7, I was seeing kids playing violin and there was a girl in my class that was studying violin. And then that was the next thing. Okay. I want to play violin like that girl. So then it was piano and violin. My parents are like, okay, let's just send up all the money that we've made to all these lessons. That's kind of how it started. I grew up through the system of the school orchestra. I took private lessons, grew up into taking lessons with some members of the Detroit Symphony. And, I don't want to say I had a purely classical background because I grew up in a house where we listened to the Beatles, you know, and listened to rock music. And there was a very eclectic mix. My dad played guitar, you know, recreationally. So we enjoyed all types of music. And so it was sort of like a fusion all along. And when I think back, it's interesting to try and deconstruct how I ended up where I am, you know, considering most people that start violin, you know, you go, you play a symphony full time or, you know, I had a very sort of unconventional path as I went through, but that's kind of how it started.
What were you listening to at that age, at that time period?
I was listening to a little bit of everything depending on the age group. I mean, you know, when I was really young, I was listening to whatever my parents put on and a lot of that was the Beatles, you know, I remember having a little boombox in my room and like turning up Back in the USSR and jumping around. And I was always fascinated with like, I guess my brain was always pulling things from what I heard in rock music and pop music and relating it to classical. And I remember sitting in my bedroom and being like, oh, there's this Beethoven sonata that I'm working on. Like, what if I cut this up and I like put this other thing? And I would sit with like pieces of sheet music and cut it up and paste it together with like another non-classical piece and go to the piano and be like, oh my God, these are the same chords. And this is like, you know, and I would, as soon as I got a laptop, I was playing on GarageBand and listening to like Bach and Paganini caprices on violin and being like, well, what if I put like a distorted guitar behind it? You know? So I was like through osmosis kind of absorbing all of these different influences. And, you know, as a teenager, I was a 90s kid. I was listening to Blink-182 and Linkin Park and, you know, very much into what was hot at the time. But I always had a very sort of eclectic, I was very like into one thing intensely for a while and then like would shift to something else. But it was all kind of happening all the time.
So your child, I mean, you started very young, as you said. Now, were you consistent with violin through that whole time, or was there like an on and off sort of period with the violin or anything like that?
I would say, I mean, I was definitely consistent. You know, it's interesting thinking back about like kids that are getting involved in music, because they're, I think it's better now, but there was very much a culture, even at the school that I was at that was arts focused. It's like music is a great thing and art is a great thing, but that's to get you into college, you know, to get into something real, like going to be a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant or something. So I think that was always sort of in the back of my mind. And maybe as a curious kid, I was always into other academic ventures too. I mean, I loved math and science. Like I did well in chemistry. I thought maybe I would be an engineer. Then I was really into being, you know, I wanted to be a lawyer, like hardcore for a while. So there wasn't ever a period where I stopped playing violin, but I think compared to maybe some kids that like knew that they were, you know, they wanted to be an orchestra musician or like a violin soloist, I was always kind of all over the place.
Okay.
You know, for quite a long time, and really throughout college as well. I mean, when I eventually went off to college, went to University of Michigan, and I was in the music school, but I also got an economics degree. And throughout all of college, even though I was like kind of even getting into a career as a musician, I was like, oh, but it's just not possible to make it as a musician. Like, it's just going to be really hard.
Right.
And I always kind of had that like thing in the back of my head of one day I'm going to have to get real, you know, which was great because I had a really well-rounded education in some ways, but also a disservice because, you know, who knows how much more I could have even done, you know, leading up to then if I had just been like, nope, music is it. And I'm just going for that.
So, did you actually study to be an attorney, a lawyer, or anything like that?
No, I didn't. I did get a degree in economics. So, I mean, I remember going, I was in the music school, and when I was at college, I remember going to a, like a pre-law advisor, and there was no pre-law program, but they said, you know, the people that do the best on the LSAT study econ or accounting. And I was like, all right, well, I love math. I'm not really going to be an engineer. So I'll do economics. And I loved it. You know, I loved going to class. I loved studying. And I kind of loved having that sort of split life of being on the academic campus and also on the music campus. And, you know, it helped me meet a lot of interesting people and think in a different way, which I think now looking back has been really useful, having that sort of business sense, or more sort of analytical way of thinking. But yeah, I went all through that, got the degree, and then I never took the LSAT or anything. I interned at a few law firms as like summer jobs and things. And I just remember almost every law firm I worked at, they were like, is there anything else you can do? Like this, this is great, but like you can do music. Like, why wouldn't you do music?
Right.
You know, but it's so funny. It's that we've always got this grass is greener outlook. Like, you know, the lawyers wish they could be artists, and the artists are like, well, maybe it would be nice to have a day job. You know,
yeah, it's kind of funny because my day job is I work for a pretty, pretty large law firm during the day. And it's the parallels between art and the attorneys. I work in the IT department of that law firm, but there's a lot of us in our firm who are really talented. I'm not talking about myself, but there are a lot of people in the firm that are really, really talented in art and music. So there's a lot of correlation or hand, they go kind of hand in hand on a lot of the people I work with. So that when you said that, it kind of was like, oh yeah, okay. I can certainly see or relate to that.
Well, there was, I'll say not to jump on you, but there was a huge crossover in music school. I had some of my closest friends were dual degree, you know, they were physics and music, or engineering and music, econ and music, math and music. There was, and I think that's just part of the, maybe it's similar personality types, you know, like the musicians can often be very type A. We're super detail oriented. We want to like analyze stuff. We're, you know, we're trying to, perfectionist, trying to decode like these intense rhythms. Everything has to be complicated. It has to be difficult, you know? And so it's like, well, it's not enough to just do one thing. You've got to also do these other things. So, so it was interesting that I, it was nice to see that I wasn't the only person that was that wild, like maxing out my schedule and like trying to do like five career paths at once.
I totally understand that. Yeah, absolutely. So moving on later on, past school and stuff like that, are you involved with live music at that point? Are you doing anything? Are you a part of an orchestra? You know, you mentioned being in the pit earlier and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say, you know, I was very lucky in a lot of ways because I had, you know, my mom growing up, she wasn't a musician, but she worked in, and still does, in a lot of radio marketing, event planning. And I just remember at the soonest age that I was able to play a complete piece, she was like, I'm going to have you play at one of my events. And I remember going to some like really big high profile events and like playing a gig at like the age of 13 and, you know, wearing a gown and like playing a classical piece. And, you know, people would come up to me and be like, oh, where are you in college? Like, where are you studying? I'm like, I'm 13. I don't know what you think, you know, but I was gigging as early as I can remember. And even, you know, throughout high school, I would do wedding gigs. And when I got into college, you know, I think a big turning point for me, and this kind of leads to how my career sort of happened organically. But, you know, while I was studying, I was always very much interested in working, you know, and being out and taking opportunities and trying to, I don't know, throw myself into the world in a lot of ways. And I have a problem with saying no. So maybe that's part of it. You know, it's like anytime someone would ask me to do something, I'm like, yeah, that sounds cool. Let's do it. But when I was in college, you know, studying classical music and also doing these other things, I got asked to play with Trans-Siberian Orchestra, in the string section. And I think I was like maybe 19 or 20, you know, and I'm going through music school thinking like, all right, I don't know if I want to do an orchestra full time. I love classical music. You know, I love what I'm learning. I love the people that I'm playing with in school. But, you know, I would think back to the childhood of like, all right, but what about that girl that was like mixing the Beatles with Beethoven? You know, it's like there's something that's not quite there. So when I did that for the first time, and, you know, it was just kind of a one-off gig at the time, I got asked to play in the string section, and I'm on stage in an arena with like 30,000 people, and there's electric guitars and singers and drums and fire and still Beethoven, right? And I'm like, oh my God, this is like the missing piece. This is exactly what I want to do, you know, because it's, you know, a lot of it had to do with the culture too, of like that freedom of, you know, not being locked into the classical traditions. You know, when you go to school as a violinist, it's a lot of like being in the box, you know, and having to play a certain way and don't move too much. Don't do this. Don't, it's a lot of don'ts, you know, whereas the rock world was like, do, you know?
Yeah, so there's no rules,
that,
right?
Exactly. So that experience was like really, really transformative to me. And I think because I loved it so much and I performed well at it, I ended up getting to do it a lot more. And the next year I played more cities, and then I was hiring string players to play it with me. And I was kind of helping arrange these sort of mini tour groups of string players, including me, that would go around and do like big chunks of regional cities. And I mean, meanwhile, I'm in school, like I'm in college and I'm supposed to be in orchestra rehearsal. And I'm saying like, well, sorry guys, I'm leaving for a few days to do some gigs. And they're like, we're going to fail you in orchestra if you do this. And I'm like, but I'm building a career here, you know, like what's going on this. So, you know, I probably got totally off the rails there, but, the answer is, I was always, always doing gigs, you know, and I think that was like super, super important for me to be exposed to what it was like to work and to like see what's actually going on in a career, because there's like, even now to this day, like still a huge gap between what you're being taught in school and how it actually works in the real world. You know, so because of all of that, you know, that grew into playing with other artists, like played with Michael Bublé for a while. I did some shows with Josh Groban. I did something with Earth, Wind and Fire, you know, and so I kind of like organically formulated this like brand as a violinist while I'm still in school, you know, and I was like the girl that would show up wearing all black to orchestra rehearsal and had like kind of rocked out, you know, and that just kind of happened on its own because I was doing this stuff outside of my like traditional educational bubble, you know? And so when I got to the end of college and it's like, I'm thinking about these other career paths, I'm like, wait, I already have the roots of a career like right here.
Right.
Just from doing that.
You're building connections too at the same time. You know, yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was TSO your first like large show, like a big show or anything like that?
I mean, definitely on that level. I mean, first arena show.
How do you prepare for that? How'd you get that gig and how'd you prepare for it?
So I was living in Michigan, and at the time, the contractor who was basically, he would be hired by TSO to find the string players and sort of arrange them all over the country. I had played at something and we got connected, and he, you know, he called me one year and was like, "Hey, do you want to do this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely. I want to do this," you know, and, you know, I had kind of the right, you know, sort of stage charisma, the right like ability to play, the right look. And, you know, that it was just kind of a stroke of luck. It was serendipity, really, like how I got that. And now I've already forgotten your question, so I might be going off the rails.
How do you prepare How'd you prepare?
Yeah. So basically that, I mean, there's not a whole lot of preparation. I mean, compared to the national touring act where they're rehearsing for like 2 months and they're doing all the choreography. I mean, I was playing in the string section. So it's, you know, they would give you the music and you could read off the music. And so you'd show up and basically you had to have like a level of technique and ability that you could just show up. And hey, it's very common, you know, like classically trained musicians, you're expected to be able to go and basically sight read through something. Maybe you need an hour, 2 hours to prepare. And then you like go on stage and you're kind of reading from the charts. So yeah, there really wasn't much preparation other than hopefully you're good enough to do this, you know, and you show up, you do, you know, we would rehearse with one of the music directors who would lead the string section and do like a maybe 2 hour rehearsal. And then you do go do a sound check and then you do two shows that day. They have an afternoon and evening show. And then that's it, you know, and it's kind of trial by fire in a lot of ways.
That's awesome. I mean, that's a pretty big, I mean, they are well known for their technical and their visual, you know, holiday performance stuff. So I feel like it's a very accurate show with all the prep work and everything like that. So that's a lot of, must be stressful.
It should be stressful, but it's funny because there's such a like dichotomy between people that are so immersed in that world of production and rock and metal and arena shows and venues, and then the classical players. Cause you know, classical players are used to not having to understand how in-ears work or monitor mixes or what EQ is or how much reverb should be, you know, on your violin or like, and this is all stuff that like, again, I had to learn by doing gigs. I learned none of this in school. You know, I learned how to play my instrument. I learned how to do orchestra excerpts. I learned violin concertos. And if I had to go do some audition somewhere for an orchestra job, that's what I was prepared to do. But no, I mean, and still to this day, you know, I go back kind of into the classical world. And it's funny because now people are like, oh yeah, Siobhan's the one that knows about the microphones and you know, like what type of mic you should use for this, the placement and like, you know, in ears and, but you know, so it's funny because going into that, you probably should be more nervous because it's a super high profile show, you know, but luckily everybody around you is kind of like taking care of you. So you don't really have to have that knowledge. You just show up and do what you need to do, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. And I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I really think what you do now is kind of the future of music in regards to this sci-fi-ish rock, symphonic, classic, all that stuff meshed together, which we'll probably talk about in a few moments here. But I think, you know, when you talk about education, it's really just theory and your instrument and what you can perform on that instrument. It doesn't really talk about the reality of the real world and where you can go beyond that information, because again, we'll talk about Starset in a minute, but I think you guys are like way off in a whole new direction that I'll kind of get to you later. But yeah, I definitely the educational system could really take some live elements, you know, because you talk about the legal world when you go through education for you actually do on the job training for that position.
Right.
But I don't think you really do in your world other than a very specific orchestra for the school or something like that. You don't go out on tour or anything like that, which is something that I think a lot of people could learn a lot about themselves in general and their instruments and the whole industry all together at once.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll say there haven't been many classmates of mine that have kind of gone off into the non-classical world, but of the few that I'm friends with and still connect with, and, you know, thank God for social media, like we're all on Instagram together. So we follow each other and still, you know, keep up with what's happened. But we all talk about this where it's like, it was like often a fight to like advocate for yourself doing something that got you out of school for a second to get like real life experience, you know? Right. And I'm not saying it's all wrong. It's important, obviously, to learn how to play an orchestra in school and to be there for your lessons and your master classes and all that stuff. But there's also, you know, the other effect of it too, is I've also seen many people that have ended up in the endless loop cycle of being in school because, you know, you do your undergrad and it's like, okay, well, I'm not ready for this yet. So I'm going to do a master's, but I'm not ready. So I'm going to go do a doctorate, and then I'm going to do a performance certificate, and then I'm going to do an artist diploma. And the thing with a music degree is it's not, if you get a law degree, you'll probably get a job as a lawyer. Like
right.
I would say 99.9% of the time. Right.
Right. Right.
But if you get a music degree, you're guaranteed nothing.
Right. Right?
You have to, it only matters whether you're going to go out and hustle for a gig or if you're going to take an orchestra audition. And even with the best music degree, you can still lose to someone else.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
So there's a massive amount of investment up front with no real meaning to the degree other than maybe if you get a doctorate and then you're applying to be a professor somewhere.
Right.
And then people, you know, they go through that and that's great. Maybe that's what they want. But for me, I saw very early on, even just being in the Michigan Music School and talking to doctorate students, they're like, man, I really thought I was going to get to work on my instrument more. And I'm writing all these papers and I'm learning how to be a professor. And I didn't even think I wanted to be a professor. I just want to be a performer. You know, yep. And meanwhile, I'm having to like argue with the school about, hey, can I go do like a massive high profile tour, you know, without failing my orchestra class?
You should get some form of class credits for that or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, now it's nice. Like, so, you know, it's skipping ahead a little bit. I mean, now is I've been in the professional world for a while and out of school for like almost 10 years, but yeah. You know, yeah. I've gone back and taken classes at Berklee online, and it's so cool to look at how different schools that are like very much geared towards the contemporary music or even jazz or rock or whatever, like how they approach education. And it's so like funny to talk back, you know, with students now that are still in classical music training, like some of the same things that are still going on, you know, and like what kind of disservice is happening to like be leaving out a lot of this stuff that's really, really important information and experience, you know?
And I wonder, I don't know the answers. I don't know if you know the answers either, but I wonder if the whole COVID shutdown of everything kind of changed a lot of the perspectives on how we educate and how people are involved with the schooling and being involved in remote environments and stuff like that too. So I just wonder how much that's changed since COVID as well.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, for me especially, that was, as someone that I think already knew a little more about technology than your average classical musician, I mean, that was a great time for me to learn like, okay, well, this could be 2 years, a year, who knows how long. I mean, I got to start a YouTube channel. I got to start doing my own stuff. I've got to figure out how to record. I mean, I don't have the money to go to some commercial studio, not to mention nobody's doing stuff because it's COVID. So I can't just go anywhere, you know? So I think a lot of people really kicked into gear and were like, all right, I gotta figure out, because it's, if you're living either the orchestra life or the freelance life and the gigs are gone, I mean, what else are you going to do?
What is there? Yeah. Unless you get into education or something like that, music education or something.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So moving on from school, you had mentioned several artists you started work with. Can you talk about how you got involved with some of those artists and what your daily activities were with those particular artists?
So, I mean, a lot of it was similar to Trans-Siberian Orchestra, where I was, you know, just getting called to do like blocks of shows or like little mini regional tours. So I wasn't involved on like the recording level or any sort of collaborative way. It was still, you know, very much kind of mostly the performance aspect and a little bit on the outside. And, you know, I guess jumping ahead to talking about Starset, one thing I love about that now is I'm involved on a much higher level than I was on, you know, as a string player. So, you know, because a lot of groups, even now, you know, when you look at it, some of the big artists, the way that, unless you're in the core band, you're the guitar player, or you might be like the lead electric violinist, which still isn't really that common. You know, people will hire string sections and it's like, all right, you're going to come on stage for 4 or 5 songs. You're a nice little feature. You're going to play some stuff and then you kind of get off stage and it's, you know, sort of low risk. You're not really having to prepare a whole lot, and you're just sort of showing up and playing. And that's very much kind of what it was. You know, my motivation was just to kind of learn to be in that arena, you know, of like performing with different people, learning from the charisma of the front men and women that I was playing with. So yeah, a lot of the artists like that I had mentioned before, like on top of Trans-Siberian Orchestra, like Michael Bublé, Josh Groban, Earth, Wind, and Fire. I played with Rod Stewart.
Were you on tour with those, or were those just when they came through, you were sort of that person?
I wasn't on the national tour. I would do like sort of regional areas. So TSO, I did the most number of cities. Like sometimes I would do like, you know, basically half of the tour, you know. Right. But some other ones, it would maybe be like, you know, a week long or 2 weeks long. It would be, you know, and a lot of it was kind of flexible because, you know, and as a freelancer, you could kind of choose, well, like if you're willing to drive to go from Michigan down to Nashville, like we're not going to stop you. Go ahead, play that. Right. So I was that girl that was like, listen, I want to play as many shows with these people as I can, because that's the best way for me to immerse myself in this small way and try and be on the edge of this world that I very much want to be a part of and learn something, you know? Yeah. So beyond the gig and beyond just the connections, a lot of it was really like an educational experience for me, just like understanding like these people that have built these massive shows and like, what are they doing? You know, what better way to learn than to like sit behind them on stage and see what they're doing backstage and to understand like the people that are involved and all these different players.
Yeah, a lot of those shows, they have such a large amount of crew members involved with setting everything up and, you know, making sure everything's dialed in and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. There's just so many people going on that you just don't realize, the average person doesn't realize how many people are involved. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about this with Starset, but a lot of those big shows, there is just so many people doing so many different things that you didn't even know was a job.
Oh no, even as a musician, I knew nothing. I didn't know. I mean, even when I first started Starset, as embarrassing as it is to say, there were certain things I would hear that's like words that I was like, what does that even mean? You know? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't even admit that I don't know this, because I'm a musician with a master's degree and 2 undergraduate degrees, and I've played in arena shows. And somehow as a string player, I've been completely immune to understanding like how an EQ works and like how to dial in my in-ear mix or how to use an iPad, you know, like it's funny. So you're totally right. I mean, yeah, it's so much that's going on and people have no idea.
Right. Yeah. Let's before we get into Starset, was there any other major things you did prior to Starset? Was there any other cool things that you want to talk about before Starset?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I'm probably blank on that. I mean, there's always been a lot of cool things. I mean, you know, and not everything has been like, you know, super high profile. I mean, I think I've had such an eclectic experience with playing with different people. I mean, after I graduated from Michigan, you know, and I was already doing a bunch of these tours here and there, you know, I made the choice, you know, I remember having this sort of fork in the road moment where it's like, all right, am I going to choose to do music as a career? Am I going to like cash my chips in now and like go to law school? Yeah. And I was interning at a law firm, like right before I decided to do a master's. Ditched that. I was like, I'm going to do a master's in music. I got a fellowship to stay at Michigan and like study some more and, you know, continue doing tours and stuff. And, you know, when a lot of my friends went on to do doctorates or go on to more schooling, I was like, forget it. I'm going to get in a car and I'm going to drive to Miami and I'm going to try and like, you know, make some sort of life for myself, get out of Michigan, get out of the Midwest and see something new. And, you know, this seems like a place where it's not crazy like New York or LA, but you know, I'm going to be around a lot of big artists and a lot of things, and I might be on the edge of something, you know?
Yeah.
So I think making that choice, you know, coming here, that's where I am right now. And just sort of throwing myself out there and trying to gain even more skills and, you know, being exposed even to jazz. I've become friends with a lot of people that are amazing jazz musicians. I have a really good friend. He's a jazz drummer, but he tours with Julio Iglesias, you know?
Cool. Yep.
So there's so many people that you don't think are doing these big things that are actually, you know, like incredible musicians that are getting called to these major gigs, and just kind of like starting forming those connections and trying to, you know, forge my own path a little bit as an independent artist. I think that was, you know, a really important move for me. After I did that and moved here, I still continued doing a lot of these tours and things, not as extensively as Starset, but that was a big thing that led me to that. So I guess that's kind of the segue into the next part
right,
of the story.
Right. Yeah. So how do you, what happens? How does that call happen? How do you get involved with them? Who do you meet? How does that work?
So it's funny. So at the time, this was 2016, and I was still doing tours with TSO, and I had moved to Florida. And so I had earlier done a lot of the Midwest stuff when I was in Michigan. And this year I was doing all the Florida stuff. So I was traveling all over doing the Florida shows for TSO. I was contracting string players. Meanwhile, doing a lot of classical things. I got involved in a lot of ensembles here and, different working with DJs and a lot of different electronic artists. And through a series of sort of random connections, there was a cellist that I had hired to play with me in TSO that got called to do Star Set. And I remember we were driving around doing some TSO gigs, and, you know, he was talking to me about this and, you know, was saying like, oh, this band called me and they're kind of up and coming. They're in Ohio. Like, I don't know. I'm in school. Like, I'm finishing my master's and I've got all these orchestra commitments. Like, should I do it? You know? And this was before I was even marginally involved. I didn't know anything about this band. I didn't know what was going on. And I was like, listen, man, if it were me, I would totally do it. Like, this sounds awesome. Like, that's right up my alley, you know? But yeah. It's a funny, you know, thinking about this story, it's like, it was a total indication of like this divide that's between sort of the rock world and the classical world. Like, you know, classical musicians are very risk averse in a lot of ways. It's like, you know, we've got our orchestra gigs that we want to play, and it would be horrible to back out of these things or to back out of school or to fail my orchestra class, you know, to take on this tour for something that maybe isn't paying that well at the time compared to what you're getting paid. But, you know, so anyway, I remember we talked about it for a while, and he eventually turned it down, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and I was surprised because I thought, well, you know, that sounds really cool. And then, you know, a week or two later, he says, you know what? They're looking for a violinist. Are you interested? I was like, absolutely. And of course, me on the other side, I'm like, God, what do I got to get out of to do this tour? You know? So I had the opposite perspective. And luckily I wasn't in school anymore, but I'm like, all right, I'm ditching this. I'm ditching that. Got my bases covered. And I'm like, you know, at the time, coming from my experience of doing tours in arenas where it's like you show up and there's catering three times a day and there's there's great food and all this stuff, it might have sounded crazy to be like, so you're going to go on a tour with a band that, like, you know, right now is doing clubs, and, you know, maybe they're not super mainstream. But I just remember looking at, you know, at Ron, who's the bass player, and he was the tour manager at the time and runs a lot of the business, you know, called me up and had looked into my profile and saw that I had, you know, I had classical chops, but I was doing some rock touring, and I was, it is sort of in that world, that sort of weird crossover world where there weren't really a lot of violinists or cellists for that matter at the time. And, you know, it was like, do you want to do this tour? I'm like, yeah, for sure. You know? So it wasn't really much of an audition process, I'll say, because I already had material out there and I had the experience, and it was more of like a, you know, come do this as a trial run. We'll see how this is when the second album had just come out. They had just gotten out of driving around the country in a Sprinter van, just got the first tour bus, you know? So I kind of walked into a pretty nice situation compared to the level of insanity and hustling that was going on among the guys that started it, you know?
Yeah. I've heard many stories of the Sprinter bus. I mean, I've talked to many people on here of the Sprinter bus years where it's just a bunch of people in a bus, not knowing when the next shower or meal's going to be, and going from town to town.
Absolutely. It's like, again, the funny comparison between the rock. I don't want to just say rock. I want to say classical, non-classical. You know, classical musicians are like, okay, rehearsal starts at exactly 7 o'clock and we are out at exactly 9:30 and we're getting paid $50 overtime if you go 2 minutes over. And meanwhile, you know, I come into a band where the stories I hear, these guys have, they're driving, and for before a Sprinter, they're driving in a van and there's no bathroom and they have to pee in a bottle and they don't know when they're going to shower, and they're either splitting a Subway sandwich because they don't have the money to pay for it. And you know, and they're setting up the show, they're playing the show, they're unloading the show, they're packing the trailer, they're driving overnight to the next city, sleeping 2 hours in a van. And it just floored me because I'm like, wow. And here I am just coming in. It's like, all right, we're going to pay you to be our violinist and we're in a bus now, you know? So it was like totally, totally different worlds, you know?
I think it was Mike Prodich previously of Red Sun Rising, now the Violet. He was saying when they were on tour, at the beginning, they would get a Planet Fitness membership.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah, that way you know you could at least have a shower somewhere in the city you're at. So
absolutely. I will say, yeah, I mean, if Planet Fitness wants to sponsor any of us, man, please, because that is like the hack of all touring musicians. I mean, we go there for showers, to work out, to park, whatever. It's like,
yep. You can invite one guest with you. Yeah.
But Planet Fitness and Walmart, those are the two go-to.
Oh yeah. So for me, I'm a musician. I'm just gonna give you a little story here. I'm a musician. I was writing some stuff for an album I was working on for a while, and I had this vision of what I wanted to do, and I could hear bands sort of doing this, and I really love the sound of a cello and an electric guitar blended together. I love those two sounds together because they give it a much bigger, more epic symphonic sound. So I was really working on this sound I was trying to go for. And I wanted to make this sci-fi rock, you know, record. I wanted to have this cinematic experience and all that stuff. And I'm like, I got a cello for Christmas and I started learning it. And I'm trying to incorporate all the stuff. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, I hear a star set. And I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And I hear, you know,
sorry, that's when we stole it.
Well, no. Dustin, what was it? My Demons was the first single or whatever it was. When I heard that, I was like, oh my God, I instantly fell in love with what I heard. I was like, oh my God, this is the best band I've ever heard. And then the album came out and I was just so blown away. And I was like, all right, well, I think you guys have got that covered. I guess I'm just going to go back to just regular guitar now. So I am a huge, huge Starset fan. And I think I probably caught you at one of your first shows. So you guys played, Rise Above Fest in Bangor, Maine.
Yes.
2017. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was backstage doing some photography and some VIP stuff for that show. So that was sort of my first sort of gig doing photography and stuff like that. And that was my first time seeing you guys live. And I was just like, holy God, you guys sound as awesome live as you do on the album. So, and you know, with all the technology going on, which I want to talk about, and stuff like that. But for you, was that how, because you had started in 2017, right?
I did. Yeah. So that would have been my first year. So my first tour was, I believe it was January. It was the very beginning of 2017.
Okay. Yeah.
It was right when Vessels had come out. That was our second album. So it was I did the first headline tour, and that might've been in the summer, that festival.
It was July. Yep.
Yeah. So it was probably maybe my second tour with the band, maybe third. Can't remember exactly, but yeah, first year for sure.
That was a pretty, I mean, for that show, I mean, I can't speak for everything, but I think you guys did a lot of festivals during the summertime, at least at that time. I'm sure it's back to that as well. But, for you, where I'm assuming you started on a regular tour and then you go through the summer festivals and stuff like that. Was that how it was for that particular year that you can,
from what I can, yeah, from what I can remember. Yeah. I mean, every year has been a little different. Like this year, for example, the summer was actually consumed. We did a support tour with Seether and Breaking Ben, and then we did a big headline tour. But yeah, a lot of the summers have either been US festivals, or we've been overseas doing some of the European festivals like Download and Rock 'em Ring and Rock 'em Park. Yeah. Those were awesome. That's a whole
other thing. Those are huge too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow.
But
So I got so many questions about all this stuff. Sorry, I didn't mean to keep interrupting. Let's go back to that first tour. What was your audition process, or was there even an audition process?
There wasn't really an audition process. I mean, I was vetted to a sense that, you know, I had sort of enough material online, like whether video, audio, and, you know, like all things in the music industry, so many things are at the last minute, you know. So I believe there was maybe like 2 weeks between being asked to do a tour or being vetted for this tour and like actually getting on the tour. So it was kind of like, you know, pretty last minute in a sense where it's like, all right, well, if we feel like you're capable enough to do this, here, learn two albums worth of songs. And basically that whole time I had to spend just kind of learning the song so that I could like do this tour.
Right.
So I think the first tour was really kind of the trial run of like, you know, and like I say, we say this even on our podcast too. It's like, you know, your ability and your talent and your technique is one thing, but like so much of it is you know, how well do you work with everybody? Like, what's your personality type? Yep. Like, does it seem like you're going to be able to grow into what is needed? So, you know, not everyone's going to be perfect. You know, it's, and it took me, there's been a learning curve for me too, because coming from like, let's say TSO, where I'm doing arena shows and I'm showing up and I've got like music provided for me and somebody is putting a microphone on me and I have absolutely no ownership of anything audio. Starset was a different thing. It's like, there was no one, you know, they were at a time where they've just gotten to the level of having, you know, like enough personnel where it's like, maybe we have one stage person in front of house and they're already stretched too thin, you know?
Right.
So I'm standing around like, where's my purse? Where's my monitor guy? Like, where's the person that's going to help me with my in-ears? And that, those people just didn't exist.
Right.
You know, it's like, you got this, you own your thing, you know, you're the violinist, you do your thing, you know? So I think a lot of it is like, all right, well, is this girl going to be able to figure out what she needs to figure out to own her part of this show? And, you know, for me, it was a much bigger part of the show than any other string position I had been in on a big rock tour, because it's like, we're on every song, you know, the violinist right. and the cellist, it's like, it is an integral part of every song and it's exposed, you know, and over the years, obviously, as we've developed and grown to more members and more help and more technology and stuff, we've become more organic because like, you know, we started with having some tracks because we only had whatever, six people in the band yeah. or five people, you know, and now it's like, there's very little that's going on other than what's actually being played by the instrumentalists.
Right. Yeah. And you guys are what, seven piece now? Is that right?
We're seven piece now. So as of like, well, less than 2 years ago, we got our seventh member, Corey, who does, yep. You know, he's on the synth and he does some backing guitar and he's got the Moog and like sort of effect stuff. And he's honestly probably one of the most high pressure situations because he's like cueing the tracks and like there's a lot of like technological savvy that goes into his job that like, if I were in that position, I don't know.
Yeah, and he's got a lot of instruments, so he's got so many things to jump back and forth.
A lot of, choreography, as I say.
Yep. So during that first tour, I'm trying to remember, I was just going back and watching the video from that show, and I know Brock and Ron are both full spacesuits.
Yep.
I don't think you were, right?
No, so we've gone through like a series of different costumes, but yeah, when I first started, it was the space suits, and then we were wearing, I believe, like just black with like a bomber jacket type thing. Oh, so yeah, okay. But the guys were like the whole show full on space suit.
And on that Rise Above Fest, it was like, it was so hot, I was dying out there. And then you guys came out in your spacesuits. I'm like, I can't imagine. Wow. I'm hoping there's AC under there or something.
I know, but every person asked that. And there is, in fact, not these guys. Like, after those shows, it's pretty horrifying to look at the state of them.
Straight to Planet Fitness.
Right. They don't even need it. They've sweat so much. It's disgusting. Yeah.
Hey, thanks for watching part one with our guest, Siobhan from Starset. We hope you enjoyed it. You can catch our other guests, our other episodes on all your favorite podcast locations. You can watch on YouTube by searching for Tales from the Pit podcast. Go to our website, talesfromthepit.net. I'm Jason, and I hope you join us on part two. This episode was edited and produced by me, Jason Levasseur. Visit talesfromthepit.net for more episodes just like this.
It's like, just as an outsider coming into like an already established band, you know, I came in after sort of the story was set and two albums were already in existence. And like, I think it's so cool that like, it's more than just a band. It's like a universe, you know? And everything, whether it's the music or the production or the technology or what's happening on stage, it's like you are entering a different world. You know, this isn't just like welcome to rock music. Like, this is welcome to the Starset universe.